There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the deal we got? I mean, the deal we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, 1208 FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile on this Tuesday. Glad to have you along, live local talk over the hour. Lots to do with this hour. And then coming up at 1 o'clock, What's Working? Special edition with my buddy Cam Marston. Coming up this hour, we will talk to the last, if you're looking back in the record books, the last time Alabama had a Democrat governor, it was Don Siegelman. And Don Siegelman joins us here in just a little bit to talk about a book he's got coming out today. And we'll talk about what it was like back then in the Blunt Mansion and looking at it now, get some of his take on this. And then there's, I just want to say this before we go any further. You heard the story that just ran there from Westwood One, and they're talking more about the renaming going on and the pushes. And we've got the petition to rename the Wallace Tunnel and some other things going on. When does it get to counties? You thought about that? Think about county names in the South. But think about maybe outside the South, but I'm just thinking the South. And we've talked about the push for, you know, renaming military installations. We've talked about renaming streets and bridges and tunnels and all these things and infrastructure. When does it move to a county level? It's Jefferson Davis Parish in Louisiana. It's not just Davis, it's not just Jefferson, it's Jefferson Davis Parish. When is that going to come up? You know, Claiborne County. I mean, we go down the list. Hale County, there's a bunch of this. You got Jefferson Davis County and, I don't know, three. Alabama doesn't have it, but three other, I think two or three. We'll check that. Hold on. I know Mississippi has this. Louisiana has Jefferson Davis Parish. I know there's got to be a couple others out there. Okay. When is the push going to, and Lee County, when does it go there? What about down in Florida, Pasco County, Florida, down there? What about that? I wonder when the call will be did, and you would then make all the people in the county, change. Now you're in a newly named county. We'll get there. All right. That's just a side discussion item that just came to mind. I want to, and I think we'll probably get an update on this story, maybe, coming up with News 5 and the update from Devin coming your way in just a couple minutes. Story came out mid-morning here at WKRG.com. Headline, arrest made in Mobile Walmart bomb threat. Mobile Police Department said they made an arrest in connection to Sunday evening's bomb threat at the Walmart, closest one to us here on the East I-65 service road. Crystal Clark, 41, was booked into the Mobile Metro Jail yesterday evening and released later that night. She is charged with making a terrorist threat. MPD says the Walmart on the East I-65 service road received a suspicious phone call by a loss prevention staff at 1:20 p.m. on Sunday. An unknown female called twice and stated that everyone in Walmart would die that night. Walmart received another call at 4:10 p.m., a woman saying that there was a bomb inside the business. Walmart notified the police and had the store evacuated. Police did not find any suspicious items for the search. Okay, so that was the story we had for Monday with a threat. Now they've made the arrest. Crystal Clark, 41. I am going to be fascinated to see if we get to ever find out. What would be the motivation for doing this? You know, often when you get these threats in, it's it's punk kids, right? It's like a, it's the punkiest of the punk kid thing ever to do, right? To call in something like that. This is a, it's a grown woman here, 41 years old, that they say is a suspect in this. It would be interesting, but that is the story that came out mid-morning. They now have a name in that arrest at the Walmart bomb threat, Crystal Clark. So maybe we'll get more information on that. All right. Coming back from the news break, we'll be joined by former governor of the state of Alabama, Don Siegelman. New book out. We'll talk about the book, but we're going to kind of talk about what it looks like now through his perspective as the last Democrat to serve as governor in the state of Alabama. And what, the last, it's been 20-something years? Something like that? All right, he joins us next right here on Midday Mobile. We're online at fmtalk1065.com. Check us out there. Also, Instagram, Facebook, which is popping right now, and Twitter.
You're listening to Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 1065. Call Sean now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. FM Talk 1065 and Midday Mobile. And it's, as mentioned, a discussion about a new book out, but also we'll go historical, I'm sure, with the book, and also a discussion of Alabama politics over the decades, joined by former governor of the state of Alabama, Don Siegelman, right now. And good afternoon. Thanks for your time.
Oh, thank you, Sean. Glad to be with you today.
Hey, and it's good to have you back on the show. New book, Stealing Our Democracy, How the Political Assassination of a Governor Threatens Our Nation. All right. Explain that headline. Explain that title.
Well, what happened to me as a sitting governor, I had the resources to defend myself. And if you just think about the unemployed housewife or a mechanic or a hairdresser, you know, they are more vulnerable. People of color, obviously, today are more vulnerable to the abuse of power, whether it's by police, prosecutors, or by presidents. And, you know, my book is, of course, it's about me in the sense that I tell about my life, how I grew up in Mobile, and how I became the person that I am, and what led me into public service. How I was elected to public office, and why and by whom I was targeted to get me out of public service. So the book is, in a sense, a memoir about me, but it's also primarily about how we save our democracy today in the face of the Department of Justice being utilized as either a weapon or a shield. And so... you know, the use of the Department of Justice or the use of prosecutions as a way to influence politics is an abuse of power that has to be brought to an end. Secondly, you know, it's unfortunate that we even have to discuss the murder of George Floyd, but. Or if you look at Michael Brown or Breonna Taylor or any of the other people who have been involved with police and have ended up dead, you know, the family members of victims should have the right to have a lawyer present in the grand jury as a check on truth, because prosecutors, in the secrecy of a grand jury, with an umbrella of protection over them by the United States Supreme Court and Congress, meaning that they have absolute immunity so that they can present witnesses who lie, or they can withhold exculpatory evidence in order to get an indictment or a conviction. We need both the defendant, in my case, me, mm-hmm. You know, I should have had a lawyer in my grand jury, and I wouldn't have been indicted. And if you have lawyers representing the family members of victims in a grand jury, there's a better chance that police who abuse their power will be held accountable.
Hey, I want to stop for a second. When you say, because you talked about this abuse of power, what? How is that manifested, abuse of power in charging people and prosecuting people that aren't guilty of something, or the way they do an investigation generally, and then plead your case to all of us on the situation that you were convicted on of you know, $500,000 solicitation?
Yes. Easy to explain. In 2010, President Obama's Solicitor General made the following argument to the United States Supreme Court. It was in the case of two men who had spent 25 years in prison for a crime they did not commit. The Solicitor General argued to the Supreme Court, and I quote, U.S. citizens do not have a constitutional right not to be framed. It is shocking to most people that people in the United States, citizens of the United States, can be framed by prosecutors, and there is nothing that you can do to protect yourself against that, criminally or civilly. The reason is the Supreme Court in 1976 gave blanket immunity to prosecutors for anything they might do. So prosecutors can willingly and intentionally present false evidence. They can cajole, pressure, threaten a witness, bribe a witness with no time in prison, which is what they did in my case, in exchange for that witness's testimony against one of their targets. In my case, that was me, obviously. So, and they can also withhold exculpatory evidence. The chief judge of the Ninth Judicial Circuit said a few years back that prosecutors withholding evidence is epidemic in America, withholding exculpatory evidence, evidence that would tend to convince the jury that the person wasn't guilty. Prosecutors can legally withhold that without fear of being prosecuted themselves or sued civilly. And in this case that was argued in 2010, they did all three. Point is, with this kind of umbrella of protection over prosecutors, there needs to be a check on prosecutors, particularly in the secrecy of a grand jury. That is where the guilty can be set free or the innocent can be charged.
But you do have your defense, Governor Singleman. I mean, that's, and I agree with, if that is going on, you have to, you know, obviously question that. But it's not like that's the grand jury's the end. I mean, it goes trial, and it's the defense team's job to point that out.
Yeah, the government, the prosecutors get 99% of all indictments they seek. 97%.
Well, you can indict a ham sandwich, right? That's what they've always said. You can indict a ham sandwich, right?
Well, and the reason they can indict a ham sandwich is because they can lie and withhold evidence that might free the defendant. But once you get indicted, your chances of getting free are very limited. 97% of those people indicted, of the 99%, 97% of them plead guilty. Why did they plead guilty? Because prosecutors can threaten them again. They can say, you know, if you do not take this 10-year deal that we're offering you, we're going to ask for 25 years to life, or we're going to wrap you up, your mother and your sister and your brother and your cousin, up in a conspiracy, and they're going to go to prison too. So it's up to you. Take 10 years or take the chance of everybody going to prison for 25 years to life. So that's why they get 97% of people pleading guilty. Then you have the 3% that didn't plead. If you go to the stand yourself as the defendant and plead not guilty and testify on your own behalf, and if you are subsequently found guilty, judges routinely add charges for perjury or obstruction of justice, because judges conclude that if you testified and the jury didn't believe you, then you must have been trying to obstruct justice or you committed perjury. So that's how the system works. And we've got to change that. And, you know, it is so easy for a prosecutor to walk into a grand jury. Let's say in the case of, George Floyd, if they wanted to, they could go into the grand jury and not present any video cam or any video evidence of the officer with his knee on George Floyd's neck. There could be no presentation of evidence of George Floyd asking for help because he couldn't breathe. There wouldn't be any evidence of a bystander asking the police to, you know, to let him breathe.
Yeah, but I hear that, but that wouldn't, that would be of note at a separate issue here. Does that change whether, and obviously the situation with George Floyd, I don't think there's any fair-minded individual that thinks, you know, that justice was done in that situation. But in a situation of what happens afterward, that doesn't change whether a crime was committed or not in the first place, right? I mean...
No, it does. It does.
How does it?
If the prosecutor... It doesn't change whether a crime was committed, but it changes whether the person is going to be charged with a crime. Let's take the case of Trayvon Martin or Michael Brown or Eric Gardner in New York, where the police officer strangled him to death on the street because he had an illegal cigarette. None of those people were not charged because nobody knows what the prosecutor presented to the grand jury. There was nobody in there to as a check on truth. So we don't know whether all of the evidence was presented to the grand jurors or not. And what I'm saying is the family members of victims of abuse of power by police should have the right to have a lawyer present in the grand jury and to object to evidence or to offer new evidence. And those questions where there's a disagreement would be settled by a judge. In a civil deposition, lawyers routinely object to evidence or testimony, and in a civil deposition, a judge makes the decision. Well, if it's important enough where monetary damages are at stake, then it certainly ought to be important enough to have a lawyer present in a grand jury where somebody's life and liberty is at stake. I was indicted because two prosecutors suborned testimony and got presented false testimony to the grand jurors and suborned testimony, meaning they convinced a witness to say something that wasn't true. And if I'd had a lawyer present in the grand jury, I'd have never been indicted in the first place.
Well, okay. And by the way, if you're just joining us here, talking to former Governor Don Siegelman, Stealing Our Democracy, How the Political Assassination of a Governor Threatens Our Nation is the book out today. So you're saying that because you didn't have a defense represented, you weren't represented by your defense there at the grand jury level, that this allowed what you've called a political assassination? I mean, are you saying that this was done because you were a Democrat?
No, it was done because I was getting ready to enter the South Carolina primary
mm-hmm.
For president, to run for the Democratic nomination for president in 2004. And clearly, there were forces at work, all tied to Karl Rove, the president's chief political advisor, who went to work to ensure that that didn't happen. We have sworn statements from two Republicans who tie Karl Rove to my prosecution. There is no question that the word was out that I had to be stopped. That's according to Jack Abramoff, who is Karl Rove's basically Karl Rove's bagman, who funneled $20 million of Indian casino money from the Choctaw Indians of Mississippi into Alabama to defeat me, first to defeat the education lottery and then to defeat me.
I want to pick up with that when we come back from the news break, because that's something you and I have talked about before on the lottery front and that timeline. Coming right back, our discussion with former Governor Don Siegelman, Stealing Our Democracy, How the Political Assassination of a Governor Threatens Our Nation. Book out today. I will talk more with Don Siegelman when we return. News is next.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile on this Tuesday. Glad to have you along. Continue our conversation with former governor of the state of Alabama, Don Siegelman. His book is out today. And, Governor, your book is available where? Online or local booksellers? Where do they get it?
Yeah, any bookstore, Books a Million, is available online at Amazon. But Thursday night, we're having a book signing event at Page and Palette Bookstore in Fairhope at 6 o'clock. So I'm encouraging all my high school friends and my cousins. I've got dozens of cousins in Mobile and Baldwin County. So I hope everybody comes out to Page and Palette Thursday night at 6 o'clock. It's Stealing Our Democracy. And I wanted to get back to the substance of our conversation. Sean, suppose one of your coworkers went to the district attorney and falsely accused you of embezzlement. And the DA takes this guy's word and puts him under oath, and he swears that it's true. He takes him to the grand jury. The grand jury returns an indictment against you. How would that impact your life? It might cost you your job. People would be questioning your credibility.
Sure.
And what good, most people have this view that we provide everybody with a lawyer, whether you're poor or not, everybody's entitled to a lawyer. Well, what good does it do to have a lawyer after you've been falsely accused and indicted of something you didn't do? Your reputation is destroyed. And in my case, my chances of winning re-election were torpedoed because I was brought to trial 1 month before my re-election in 2006 by a prosecutor whose husband was the campaign manager for Bob Riley. All the while, my trial was about a campaign contribution to the education lottery proposition that was going to provide free college education for everybody. I wasn't accused of benefiting by a single penny. But while I was trying to raise money so that Alabama children and their would have the ability to have early learning and free college, the Mississippi Choctaw Indians were sending in $20 million to defeat that proposition and to make sure that, quote, I was stopped. They had their crosshairs, their guns sighted on me. They wanted me out of office, and so did Karl Rove. That's the end of this story. But the point of this book is we have got to take steps to ensure fairness in our criminal justice system, whether it's for the victim of police violence or the victims of prosecutorial misconduct by prosecutors. And we also need to hold presidents accountable for their behavior as well. And that can only be done through a grand jury. I want to go to General Flynn for just a minute. There have been serious questions raised about the conduct of the FBI in regard to his indictment.
Mm-hmm.
The initial charge against General Flynn was that he was colluding with the Russians to impact the outcome of the 2016 election. Well, Robert Mueller and the FBI couldn't find anything that tied him to an effort to influence the outcome of the 2016 election. So one rogue FBI agent who was fired later decided that it might be cute. He said, look, I think I can get him to lie if we get him in a situation. There's this act that was passed by Congress in 1799. And
the Hatch Act,
So my point is, to ensure that the government plays fair with every citizen, regardless of whether it's the president or the unemployed housewife, we need to take precautions in the grand jury. My book is about correcting some of the flaws in our criminal justice system. We've got a great system. I haven't been to every country, so I can't say it's the best best judicial system in the world. But we know we've got a good one. We've got a great democracy. We've just got to make sure that it functions the way we all know that it can and should.
Let's take us back. Let's talk history here. And the $500,000 that we discussed, that and you pointed out that this is going to fund the push for the education lottery. Did you offer exchange with Scrushy that seat for the $500,000?
Let me explain this. I think anybody listening can get this. Richard Scrushy was head of HealthSouth. It was a Fortune 500 company. I think maybe the only one in the state at the time, maybe one of two. But he had served on the something called the Certificate of Need Board, which oversees hospitals and nursing homes regarding their equipment and the number of beds they have. He had served through Bob James, Guy Hunt, and when Jim Folsom was president, was governor, he was reappointed again. So he had served through three different administrations. He had resigned from that board. He wasn't on the board. And I asked him if he would serve on that board again, and I'm raising my right hand and asking God to strike me dead as I give this statement. When I asked Richard Scrushy if he would serve on this board again, his statement was, quote, "Oh, Governor, do I have to? I just got off that board." And he went on to explain that it takes up 2 days, takes up too much time. And then he said, "Can I just give you the name of a good person who would serve on it?" And I said, "No, because if you leave the board now, after serving through two Republican administrations and one Democratic administration, it's going to look like you're walking away because I'm a Democrat." And he wouldn't even agree to that. I had to get Elmer Harris, the president of the Alabama Power Company, to go talk to him to convince him to serve on the board. So there was no quid pro quo, no evidence of a quid pro quo. The judge, in order to get me convicted, had to tell the jury that they could consider the contribution to the ballot initiative so that kids could have free college education as a thing of value to me personally, because I supported the ballot initiative and was pushing for its passage, and it would help me politically. Nobody in the history of American jurisprudence has ever been to jail on anything like that before or since my conviction. This was totally contrived by Judge Mark Everett Fuller, with whom I'd had any number of political conflicts over the years. So he shouldn't have even been the judge on my case.
You know, talking about that time period, and, you know, you mentioned Abramoff, his book, and I've talked about a lot with the unlikely bedfellows that came together in opposition of the lottery back then, with the interest of people that are standing on the morality side, along with people standing on the business side, i.e. the tribes out of Mississippi. Okay, that's one side of it. You're fighting for the lottery on the other side. Is the motivation in your mind to run through with this prosecution and do this from Karl Rove? Is it all about the Democrat primary and fear of you as a candidate, or was it somehow linked to the lottery issue? Were they separate or were they connected?
They were definitely connected. And here's how they were connected. In my book, I explained that Ralph Reed was head of this organization that he created called the Christian Coalition. Well, the Christian Coalition took $4 million from the Choctaw Indian casinos to oppose a lottery. Let me say that again. The Christian Coalition was funded by casino money.
Sure. We've talked about that, on the show,
Because they didn't want opposition to their gaming monopoly in Alabama, in the Southeast. So, what is the link between the Abramoff, Ralph Reed, and Karl Rove? They were not only the threesome in the college Republican days, but they were also in communication with each other during the time that all of this was going down, there are emails from that link Ralph Reed to the White House during this period of time. So, anyway, the story is explained in my book, Stealing Our Democracy, which I hope everybody will get from your local bookstore, Books A Million, or at Page and Palette Thursday night. I'll be there at 6 o'clock. But we have sworn testimony from two Republicans that Karl Rove was involved in my prosecution. So it's not, I think it may have been a confluence of both politics and money, but clearly there was a connection between Karl Rove, Jack Abramoff, and Ralph Reed that led to my demise as both governor and as a potential candidate against George W. Bush in 2004.
What do you think about on the lottery front to hear the discussions now? Of course, things derailed with the COVID-19, and they didn't get to everything on the agenda. But here we go. I mean, it's been, you and I first talked a couple years ago when I said, what does it feel like to sit there and look at a lottery bill that in the House and Senate both came from the Republicans?
Well, I was able to get the constitutional amendment on the ballot with the help of Republicans, both in the House and Senate, when I was governor in 1999. The trick is going to be to get it passed by the people once the amendment is approved for a ballot referendum. And if they do not allocate all of the money to scholarships and to early learning, I don't know that the people of Alabama will buy off on it. And that is the problem with the current proposal, because they want to use this lottery money as a panacea for solving, for building new prisons or whatever, whatever the case may be. But if they isolate the money to go to children, to help children reach their God-given potential through education, then everybody feels good about that. And I think it will pass by the Alabama voters.
I think if the money went to whatever, if the money went to expanding the pool at the Blunt Mansion, people would probably vote for, at least have a ballot amendment there for lottery. What about the offer here from the Porch Band of Creek Indians to come in and offer a deal here, just straight money to the state to have a monopoly on gaming in Alabama?
I'd shut it down in a heartbeat. I wouldn't even consider it. If we're going to have gaming in Alabama, then the people of Alabama need to get the full benefit from that. And what I had proposed, and this is one reason why the Choctaws got so upset, and the Porch Creek Indians, because I was going to give the people in the first congressional district the right to vote. And if it passed in one of the counties or more, like Baldwin and Mobile, y'all have paid the economic price of the casinos over in Mississippi. And if you voted to have a casino in Baldwin County and Mobile County, I felt like the counties should have the right to open casinos. And the same with Montgomery and Birmingham and Huntsville. So I do not think that we should give the Porch Creek Indians a monopoly on gaming in Alabama to the detriment of the people of Alabama. It makes no sense.
All right. Remind folks again, you have the event, the book signing, coming up at Page and Palette this week?
Yes, sir. Page and Palette in Fairhope. It is a third-generation independent bookstore, actually owned by the partly owned by the mayor of Fairhope, Karen Wilson. And we're going to be there a little before 6 and stay there until all the books are signed. I'll be answering questions. Hopefully not as tough as yours, Sean. Thank you very much. Well, but anyway, we're going to have a good time Thursday night at 6 o'clock at Page and Palette Bookstore in Fairhope.
All right. New book, Stealing Our Democracy, How the Political Assassination of a Governor Threatens Our Nation. Former Governor of the State of Alabama, Don Siegelman, thank you for your time. Thanks for being on the show.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right, it's 12:49. Coming right back. Get your calls and comments here. Plus, coming up at 1 o'clock, Cam Marston, What's Working Special Edition. We'll talk more about that in just a couple minutes. Be right back. Remember, FMTalk1065.com. You can check us out Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I was watching my daughter and her friends TikToking over the weekend. Dalton, I've got some TikTok lessons. We're going to have to create some TikTok content for the kids. I'll be working on that. Be right back. News is next.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, 12:53, FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Y'all say hello to my buddy Angelo at Mobile Bay Coins and Fine Jewelry. Hey, Angelo.
Hey, how's it going, everybody?
Good, good. This is what we call, here we go. This is what we call a call to action. A call to action. Angelo, call them to action.
Yeah, we have a lot of people that come into the shop and they say, I've been thinking about getting into gold and silver. I've wanted to start buying some gold and silver bullion, but I've been waiting and waiting and waiting, and I don't really know what to do. And for those people out there that are still on the fence and still haven't decided, come to the shop, 2204 Government Street. Come in and tell us, hey, I've been thinking about this. Talk to me. Explain how this works. We would love to talk to you. Explain all about gold and silver bullion, whether we're talking those little bricks of silver, those little bricks of gold, or the cool pop culture coins that are gold and silver. We have lots of interesting stuff in stock. We love to talk about what we do. And maybe we can take some of that mystery out of all of this, and you can stop thinking about doing it, and you can actually start doing it.
I love it. All right, let's do this as well, because I talk about that y'all do the appraisals, and I've had my mom in there doing appraisals with y'all before on stuff, and in the asymmetric way that is FM Talk 106.5, our buddy Cam Marston, who comes on at 1 with What's Working Special Edition, is already sitting in the studio. He's showing me a picture of, what is that, Cam?
This is my grandfather's pocket watch when he graduated from Loyola University in the 20s, and I've had it as it's a family heirloom. It's etched into the back, but I have no idea what it is or any of the story. I'm hoping someone could tell me about it.
Yeah, and see, you've got a pocket watch. You know, if Cam's got his grandpa's pocket watch, you've got a shoebox full of jewelry from grandma. Maybe you've got a coin collection that's been passed down to you. Bring those items by the shop. It is a free appraisal. Shoebox size and smaller usually only takes a few minutes for us to go through it. We'll probably open up the back on the watch. We'll look at the hallmarks on the jewelry, sort some of the stuff out, and tell you what your items are worth today. And again, no charge for that appraisal, because you got to start knowing what your stuff is worth. And if grandpa's watch is really rare and valuable and expensive, or is it just something cool that you can put up on the mantle next to his picture?
There we go.
So, once again, tell folks how to come down, and whether they're bringing a pocket watch or jewelry or just getting an idea of what's, other things are worth, how do they find you?
Yeah, we're in Midtown at 2204 Government Street. Of course, you can check us out online, mobilebaycoins.com. And if you're very busy and have a hard time getting down here, go on to Facebook or Instagram, like and follow us there, or send us a picture of those items. Maybe we can give you a rough idea what we're looking at.
All right, Angelo, we appreciate it. We'll talk soon.
Have a good one, guys.
Hey, you too. Angelo checking in from Mobile Bay Coins and Fine Jewelry. It's just news just breaking everywhere. So we had the arrest made in the... they had a suspect in this phoning in the bomb threat to the Walmart over here on the East I-65 service road, just on the east side of the studio, really not far from us here. That story. And then I saw this from Debbie Williams, who is great, by the way. Debbie Williams, one of the great reporters in our area. This posted up just about the time we went on there, so that's why I didn't see it. U.S. Senate candidate and former Auburn University football coach Tommy Tuberville says he has not been contacted by President Trump's campaign about a rally at Ladd People's Stadium in Mobile next month. Now, what I was talking about this morning, and we discussed to some degree yesterday, that I got the call last week that said the president would be looking at July 11th, Ladd People's, for an event to campaign for Tommy Tuberville. And this morning we talked about the significance of that. Ashley asked that question of Jeff Sessions when he was on with us in the 8 o'clock hour. And asked Quinn Hillier about it as well. Well, now is here's a report from Debbie. She says News 5 caught up with Tuberville in Orange Beach this morning between meetings on economic development. The former coach says he spent time with the president last weekend in Dallas. That's what I was referencing this morning when you saw them both coming out of Air Force One. Said he spent time with him in Dallas, and rally in Mobile was never brought up, but he thinks it's a good idea. Of course you would. I would think it's a good idea. If I was campaign manager, I said, sweet. And so CNN White House correspondent Caitlin Collins reported President Trump's intention to visit the Port City. However, a spokesperson for the city of Mobile said the White House has not yet contacted the city. We also reported that Lanyap, in their reporting, had come out and said Ann Davis with Land People Stadium said they hadn't heard anything of it. President has endorsed Tuberville over Sessions in this race. So, I mean, you would, but let's go down the list here. So, Caitlin, I think Caitlin Collins, we got somebody Google her for, I think Caitlin's from Alabama. I think she went to Alabama. I think Caitlin went to University of Alabama, Roll Tide, if I'm right. But that report that Caitlin Collins ran with is what was bouncing around last week. And I, you know, when somebody asked me not to say something, I didn't say something. But now you've got the person that would benefit Tuberville saying that he hadn't heard of it. You have the city of Mobile said they've had no contact from the White House, and the management at Land People Stadium saying they hadn't heard about it. It sounds like people got some explaining to do on this. All right. What's working? Special edition on the way. You ready?
I'm ready, man. I'm ready. I've brought content.
You always do. That's why we stick around. He's coming up in 6 minutes right here on FM Talk 106.5.